as we encroach on various natural systems, things bubble up, and that is in fact true, but actually we are doing a lot to make them bubble up, and that's not very well understood or appreciated.
Today, we welcome to the podcast Dr. Richard S. Ausfeld to discuss the ecology of infectious disease, including Lyme's disease and other tick-borne illnesses, in this edition of the PeerDirect Specialist Spotlight. I'm your host, Senior VP and Medical Director, Dr. Tim Wright, and joining me today is Dr. Richard S. Ausfeld, a disease ecologist at the Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies. Dr. Ausfeld, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Tim. I appreciate being here.
So to start off, if I may, how does one go about becoming a disease ecologist?
Well, typically one starts by being a more conventional ecologist, but recognizing that pathogens that cause disease are organisms too. And so in very important ways, they fall well within the discipline of ecology, which looks at the interactions between organisms in nature and how that affects the world around us, population abundance, population growth, the distribution of organisms in space, etc.
And I would say that we've probably been taught, we hope we've learned from that lesson that we've probably been taught over the past few decades, that when we encroach on certain areas, things sort of pop up and bubble out, you know, not the least of which probably was the last pandemic or other viruses and bacterias. I'm particularly interested, and one of the reasons I asked you to be on the podcast is that your, you know, research about ticks, hosts, and biodiversity, in particular how Lyme disease is sort of one of your, you know, apocryphal tales. If you can talk a little bit about that to get us started.
Well, I guess I would reflect back on what you said a moment ago, that yes, as we encroach on various natural systems, things bubble up. And that is, in fact, true. But actually, we are doing a lot to make them bubble up. And that's not very well understood or appreciated by the broader world. We actually, when we disturb natural systems, we inadvertently are making life much better for the creatures that we have to worry about, especially things like rats and mice and sometimes bats, or various kinds of farm animals that are often the best hosts for what we call zoonotic pathogens, the ones that are shared between vertebrate animals and us. And so it's not just that we're encroaching into their territory, we're actually acting like filters where we filter out and get rid of the protective species, and we actually exacerbate the dangerous species. And that's certainly the case with Lyme disease. When we fragment forests or destroy biodiversity, we tend to make life just rosy for things like white-footed mice and chipmunks, which are the main culprits responsible for supporting tick populations and tick infection with those pathogens.
And I would also say maybe sort of and because my daughter went to the University of Vermont, I read that sort of the mountain lion or the catamount, you know, has been extinct for forever. Wolves are gone from New England, and we've certainly chased and harassed coyotes and foxes to their extent. So obviously we've also, because we vilified certain species, eliminated some of their predators. And so you've talked a little bit about suburban development sort of in the Northeast shaping, you know, tick density and human exposure. You know, sort of what are those specific land use features that we're doing that are sort of messing things up that they were naturally, and how can we address that?
Well, some of those species that you mentioned, all of them ones that you mentioned, are predators, right? And we know from basic ecological principles that predators, which are consuming other animals, need a lot of space. Unlike a cow in a pasture, which needs very little space because what they're eating is grass and clover. And if there's plenty of it in the area that a cow can get to when it's even lying down, it will happily stay right there. But not so with a catamount or a wolf or a coyote or a weasel or a barred owl or a red-tailed hawk. Because they're eating things that are widely distributed and scarce, they need a lot of space. So the main thing that people do to make life miserable for those predators is to carve up the habitat into little bits that, that are too small for populations of those predators to persist. And we're very good at doing that. And when we do that, the prey species, which are often small mammals like mice, shrews, chipmunks, thrive. And when they thrive, the data tell us, so do ticks, and so do the pathogens that reside within those ticks and get transmitted to us.
You know, and you would think, if one studied, and I'm a little bit of a amateur medical historian, perhaps the plague and the Black Death, that, you know, we've learned this lesson before, providing lovely habitats and, you know, persecuting predators. Although interestingly, some predators, proved to be a worthy opponent. I also happened to spend some time out on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and the coyotes have adapted and come back despite everyone's best efforts. So clearly we're doing things that are not in our best interest. One of the things that also seems to have popped up that caught my attention, and I'm going to probably mispronounce this, and you've corrected me already, is the Powassan virus. Can you talk a little bit about that as sort of the next thing that's come from the tick-borne diseases and what you know about that?
Right. So Powassan virus, at least that's how I understand it's pronounced. It was named after a town in Ontario where it was first characterized, first discovered as a pathogen, is transmitted by the same black-legged ticks that also give us Lyme disease and anaplasmosis and babesiosis. Mm-hmm. And it's the rarest of all those tick-borne diseases in terms of number of cases in the human population. And one of the rarest when it comes to the prevalence of infection in the black-legged tick population. So when you grind up, you know, 1,000 ticks, how many are infected with Powassan virus? Well, only a handful are, as compared to, so it's roughly about 1% to 4 or 5% of the ticks that you capture when you're out looking for ticks in the woods are infected with Powassan virus. And that's about 10 times lower than is the case for the Lyme disease bacterium, which is, you know, somewhere between 10 and 40 or 50%. And so the other thing that's different about Powassan virus than any of these other tick-borne pathogens is the speed with which it can be transmitted to a person once the tick starts to feed. With Lyme, it takes at least a day and a half, maybe 2 days. With Powassan virus, it has been detected being transmitted into the host, including us, within 15 minutes, and certainly much of it takes place within a few hours. So that makes it scary. I guess another scary thing is how devastating it can be,
right,
in when it manifests itself in a patient, causing encephalitis, sometimes death, sometimes lasting disability for survivors. So it's a scary disease that I'm quite worried about. And I guess the silver lining is that it remains so rare. So it's scary, but not a high probability disease to get, even in New England or the upper Midwest, where tick-borne diseases are rampant.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it just goes to add on to this. When I read the article in the Boston Globe, you know, the clinicians were sort of like, what is this? And they actually had to go to sort of a tertiary center infectious disease specialist. But it just adds another reason why we should all take sort of the normal tick precautions when we're outside. And that brings me to the next question, because I'm of an age and when, you know, cold winters were about, and, you know, you could look forward to the ticks maybe taking a couple of months of stasis so they weren't out biting. Can you talk a little bit of a sort of climate change and tick expansion and, you know, geographic spread? All of these things, obviously, right in your wheelhouse as an ecologist.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the study of the impacts of climate change on tick-borne disease are ongoing. And it's a very difficult question to address to get answers with a great deal of confidence. You can't do an experiment where you have replicate Earths and you warm some right. of them and you keep other ones unwarmed. I wish we could be a control Earth, but we're not. We're the experimental Earth, but there's only one of us. So in terms of causal inference, it's a very difficult question to address. The evidence, to my reading, suggests that climate change is having and has had a strong impact on the geographic spread of the disease, but it is not the only factor involved. Right. So a lot of the northward spread up into northern New England, into southern Canada, and westward spread as well, which is also into more continental, less equable climates than the sort of original climate along the southern New England and New York coast, that is consistent with climate warming. And the mechanism, the most likely mechanism, is that the warming conditions extend the season in which the ticks can seek a host. And springs are earlier. That's demonstrably the case with climate warming. And winters are later. So that gives various stages in the life cycle of the tick more of a chance to find a host, which they must do or they will die. They feed on one thing and one thing alone, and that's the blood of a vertebrate. And that's a tough way to make a living. So they need a lot of time to find a hospitable animal to crawl onto and to spend the better part of a week feeding from. The cold snaps in the winter are not associated with an impact on tick populations, at least according to our data. But the extensive season earlier in the spring, later in the fall, helps tick populations grow. And that's not good for us if we want to avoid tick-borne disease.
Absolutely. I think, you know, and just to bring in another species that, you know, you probably don't care that much about, where I am here in Western Mass, the woolly adelgid is attacking hemlocks, and it either dies off or is in stasis if you get down to the single digits or the low double digits. And we haven't had winters like that, and now it's just sort of spreading rampantly.
Yeah, no, the woolly adelgid is an excellent comparative system to ask about black-legged ticks because they differ. And there is strong evidence for cold snaps in the winter knocking off woolly adelgid populations and setting limits to their geographic range, because they have no escape from those conditions. They're up in the trees, on the leaves, in the bark, all year. The black-legged ticks are not the same. So they are able to get down on the ground, even in the ground, in little soil pores and under the leaf litter, where they are able to escape some of those harshest conditions. Right. So after all, some of the densest black-legged tick populations are in northern Wisconsin and Minnesota, where it's still mighty cold, even in this warming climate. So we've been fooled into thinking that ticks, which are not insects, behave like insects in some important ways, and they differ from insects like the hemlock woolly adelgid in that critical way.
Right. If I remember my etymology correctly, they are in the arachnid family or close to it.
You're remembering it very well. Yes, they're more closely related to spiders than they are to insects. Yep.
I was paying attention to that class, I guess. That was a while ago. Yeah. But I think as an emergency medicine physician, we always paid attention to zoonotics because practicing in this part of New England, you know, you become adept at taking off ticks, and you became adept at treating and even, you know, giving prophylactic to tick bites and so forth. So switching gear a little bit and then having you put on sort of, you know, look into your crystal ball, aside from, say, Lyme and Powassan, you know, what other sort of vector-borne illnesses or tick-borne illnesses do you think are going to expand or show up? Or is it just sort of like when it shows up, we'll have to deal with it?
Well, we're sort of stuck dealing with it retroactively, reactively, once they show up. Our ability to predict what and where is still very limited. But we know that babesiosis is increasing in incidence and in its geographic range. Anaplasmosis is as well. And we still discover other tick-borne pathogens when we look carefully enough. And sometimes that looking is spawned by some, you know, new symptomology in some cluster of patients or non-cluster of patients. And then we start trying to figure out what it is, because it isn't what we think it is. And then we suddenly find that there's some new strain or an entirely new pathogen. That happened with Borrelia miyamotoi, so a relative of the Lyme disease bacterium. And that appears to be increasing in frequency as well. And there are other viruses in these black-legged ticks and in other tick species like dog ticks and Lone Star ticks, right, both of which can be very abundant in our area.
That was interesting you brought up Lone Star ticks because, you know, when I did my medical training in the southwest part of this country, you know, I was trained to think about Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And then when I came back to New England to practice, I'm like, well, we're way far away from the Rocky Mountains. And then all of a sudden it shows up and you're like, what the heck is going on here? Of course, you know, we also happen to keep in our household on purpose some other hosts to these ticks, namely dogs and cats. And so, and they're also almost as mobile as we are. If you've, you know, people transport their pet across country. So, you know, boundaries don't mean, I guess, as we found out, you know, people jumping on a jetliner and being somewhere or on a car or train, that it's not the way it used to be where diseases stayed in one specific locale.
Yeah. Well, you're right that, you know, the movement of people, the movement of their pets or companion animals, and then natural movements by free-ranging animals also play a role. So there's some evidence that birds migrating during particular seasons might be carting ticks of important life stages in the tick life cycle into areas where they formerly didn't occur or had very low abundance. And if you get enough of an inoculum of new ticks, even if it's if the probability of surviving is low, you get enough of them, then a population could get established. And that is part of the difficulty of studying the system. There are a lot of modes of travel for these ticks and the pathogens themselves, and little understanding of the impact of those on the patterns that we see.
Yeah, I think as a physician, you've definitely talked to the audience about inoculum, that we're all for antibiotic resistance. We know if we don't get them all, then one of them who survived the antibiotic is going to breed out a resistant population or something new. And that's always terrifying to people who, you know, are in the field of medicine.
Yeah.
And so my public health background makes me ask this next question. And I don't mean to put you on the spot, but what sort of activities or preventive strategies, you know, rooted in your ecologic stewardship, can we take? You know, I think it sometimes as an individual or as a small community, we feel overwhelmed and we think, oh, well, you know, government needs to address this, and I'm sure it's on many levels that we could address this, but what are sort of the things that we should be advocating to try to slow this down or maybe turn it around?
Yeah, that's a super tough one. It's a real conundrum. I mean, we are stuck in a situation where the government is doing next to nothing to protect us. This is one of these sets of diseases, these tick-borne diseases, just with Lyme as sort of the poster child, where it's the individual patient or the patient's family that's responsible. And to be honest, for the interventions that are known to work, it's pretty much an individual level question. So doing tick checks, wearing repellents, using protective clothing, being aware of what ticks look like, where they're likely to hide on you, what the early symptoms of tick-borne disease are like, so you can seek medical attention when you think you might have something like that. Those are effective. Yet environmental interventions have not been shown to be effective in protecting human health, in actually reducing the probability of getting sick from a tick-borne disease. And so Felicia Kiesing and I just completed the Tick Project, which was asking whether two tick killing interventions, when deployed either singly or together, could reduce tick abundance sufficiently to actually reduce the incidence of tick-borne disease in households and neighborhoods, in neighborhoods that are afflicted by tick-borne disease. And the answer was no. That we reduced tick populations by about 50%, but saw no reduction in the incidence of tick-borne disease in entire neighborhoods. And this was a placebo-controlled, double-blind, randomized, basically field-based clinical trial. It was the gold standard of scientific experimental design. So nevertheless, there are industries that are conducting tick control in people's yards and their neighborhoods. And to my knowledge, it's expensive. And some of the chemicals that are being used are potentially dangerous ecologically, mostly not to humans, but there are some exceptions to that. And we do not have evidence that that protects you or your family from exposure to tick-borne disease.
Right.
So that becomes very problematic. So I don't know what to tell the government to do at this point. We need more research, which I know is a glib answer or non-answer, but it happens to be true in this case.
You know, it's interesting. It's not a non-answer for anyone who's been involved in any kind of research. I mean, my master's thesis was a different topic, talking about something specifically different. And I spent an entire summer going through data and then came up with a hypothesis that I presented to all these child protective service people that had to do with shaken baby syndrome. And they were like, this is totally opposite of what we thought it was. And it was like, yeah, you've got to do the research to find answers to things. And I would also make the point that, yes, you can look for anywhere in New England or Massachusetts where they're going to spray permethrin at best, which I also think may have some environmental impact as an estrogen blocker or something on some species. Mm-hmm. I also have known people who have have gotten themselves a tiny herd of guinea fowl to walk around their yard and eat ticks. But I have to agree with you. I think that, you know, taking care of your person and your families with barriers and so forth is probably, you know, the best line of defense.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that's supported by the science. And the science tells us that just because something, whether it's a guinea fowl or permethrin, is capable of killing ticks, does not mean that it can control tick populations sufficiently to protect your health. So, and in the few other sort of rigorously designed field studies using tick control methods, even up to a 60 or 70% reduction in tick populations is not demonstrated to do the trick. So can we do better than that? Maybe, but we don't have the study yet to do that. And what's the spatial scale over which we have to control ticks? And then yes, permethrin wipes out insects, spiders, butterflies, moths, you know, things that we care about, things that are important in pollination, that feed the rest of the food chain, that support the birds that we value and that serve important ecosystem services. So they're not without their costs. And if there's no known benefit, then even a modest cost doesn't make much sense to incur.
Right. Spray it on your clothes and keep it out of the environment. You know, Dr. Ausfeld, this has been an amazing talk. I like to thank you very much for your time. This has been very informative. Thank you so much.
Well, my great pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
And that's today's Specialist Spotlight. Thank you for joining us for this episode of PeerDirect Medical News Podcast. For more stories like these, visit us at PeerDirect.com. Thoughts, comments, or suggestions? Please leave us a review on your preferred listening platform or email us at editorial@PeerDirect.com. Subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Pandora, Apple Podcasts, or TuneIn. You can also download our Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing Medical News Roundup and just ask, what's my flash briefing? Thanks today to our guests, Dr. Richard S. Ausfeld and Deshaun Mullen, Norm Dion, and Kate Rio for production assistance. Join me next time for an episode where we cover the latest stories in the world of medicine.